I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold. We've heard so many perspectives about money on this show, from Belgium's central banker André last week to Dariel and Rivera's story of the billionaire Buddha in episode 20 in Midsummer. How is endless growth built into the actual design of money? Does participating in that system and accumulating lots of money actually make us happier? Should we even have to work for money to have our basic needs met? These are questions we are here to explore on this podcast, and we are super excited this week because we think our guest Pedram brings some important nuance to this conversation.
Pedram Shojai is a doctor of oriental medicine and former monk turned entrepreneur. He's an author, a filmmaker, and the founder of Well.org, a health and wellness platform at the intersection of health, environmentalism, and conscious capitalism. We asked him for his take on our current economic system, the things that need to change, and where he sees the world going in the future.
Here is Pedram.
Hello, my name is Dr. Pedram Shojai, founder of Whole TV, theurbanmonk.com, books, movies, all kinds of stuff in the media space. Didn't start here. Started as a doctor of Oriental medicine and a Taoist priest trying to save the world. And I realized what I was doing was too small, and I needed to get into the propaganda game to stop the slide, the inevitable slide downward. At first, it was in healthcare and it was in medicine, running these clinics, trying to fix people. It's kind of like being in the MASH unit, just patching up soldiers. And, you know, there's no end in sight unless you go, you know, drive up the road and negotiate a peace. And so that was my kind of first foray into media, is saying, man, this ain't working. I could work myself to my bones. I could be exhausted every single day, and they're coming in faster than we could fix them. Because we were losing the media game. We were losing it to the pharmaceuticals. We were losing it to the pill for an ill model. And, really, if you want to change the healthcare system, you got to change how people live, right? It's a lifestyle game. So got into media, got into all these really interesting areas in health and wellness coverage of some of these stories. And it eventually led me to follow the breadcrumbs into this concept of conscious capitalism. And it was enough to warrant an 18-month journey. I did a film called Prosperity back in, like, wow, I was like 2016 or something now. Followed the captains, basically, of the conscious capital movement. How'd you get into this mess? What are your intrinsic motivators, extrinsic motivators? What is it about this movement that shows a lot of promise, and where are we stuck? It's a convoluted mess. There's a lot of well-intentioned people out there. There's a lot of people pretending to be well-intentioned. A lot of people get, media coverage for saying they're well-intentioned, and everything in between, right? And so, it led down a journey and an inquiry into entrepreneurship, capitalism and socialism, and, kind of the evolution of capitalism through, the founding fathers like Adam Smith. And, these people had a lot to say. Partially in a world that was very different than today's, but partially not really, right? Like, how are we exchanging our time and our energy for value? What is this value? How do we, put it into an exchange that's fair and equitable, yet rewards the guy who gets up and hustles, right? There's a certain degree of complexity to it, because, look, I'm the CEO of three companies, one of which we're selling right now. I sleep less than your average guy. I work harder than your average guy. I get up and I work, way more. And when your average guy is watching some dumb TV show to numb his mind, I'm still working. So is it fair to have the same amount of money? Is it fair to have the same amount of wealth? Right? And, these are questions that our generation needs to answer.
I wonder if you ever kind of went into what is the premise of conscious capitalism? Like, how does self-interest versus collective interest play into your thinking here? Is it really just working hard and being and relying on people to take into account the ecology and other people? Or is there some system that you would prefer over what's here now?
I mean, it's a good question. I mean, look, there are It's a tough situation, right? Like we live in a world where, especially now, I mean, I don't know when this thing's going to air, but you know, there's this thing called the Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And I came to understand that, look, if you can't take care of your basic needs, feed your family, keep your shoes on and keep your heat on and all things that are in front of us, especially now during the pandemic, you don't give a damn about conscious capitalism. You don't give a damn about other people. I mean, people care about themselves. And once they're fed and once they're happy and once they're satisfied and satiated and all these types of things, then they can start to care about others. But, you know, I just, you know, going into this very, you know, philanthropically minded, coming from a monastery and a monk, you know, monk background and all this, you know, I became kind of brutally aware of the extrinsic versus intrinsic motivators that drive people to care about others. And you know what, if you're still in the animal brain and you're still trying to put food on your table, you could give a damn about conscious capitalism. And so it's almost like a luxury conversation to some because of the way the system is set up, right? And it's just, it's part of what needs to be in this dialogue.
So that's an interesting perspective. From a monk, you don't really live your life for your self-interest. You live a fairly humble life, right? But you are already, in the case, thinking about the greater good at some level, right? Living piously or living connected to nature or whatever that belief system is. And then you decided that's not enough. I need to have a bigger impact. And you mentioned propaganda as the name for that bigger impact. Is that really the only path? I mean, what is it that... Is it surrendering to the capitalistic model that, or the fact that people respond to propaganda? Is that what made you go in that path, or like what really is at the base of that choice?
Well, I mean, my entire brand is called the Urban Monk, right? And I went from an ascetic to a householder in a transition that you know taught me a lot about the ways of the world. Right. And to live in the world and have cell phone bills and gasoline for your car and a roof over your head and all the things that, you know, are kind of the prerequisites to, you know, survival. And then starting companies and having payroll and advertising and all the things that are incredibly challenging and put you in the realm of, you know, market economics and all the things that are drawing your attention out into this world of money. It's easy to say, look, you know what? It's dog eat dog. It's, you know, might versus, you know, might makes right. And, you know, it's all about the mighty dollar. But it doesn't have to be, right? And so for me, the last 20 years has been really espousing this concept of right livelihood as the Buddha taught it, and really looking at how we can live within a market, make an impact, enrich ourselves in a way that's fair and equitable and, you know, supports our family and puts our kids through school and all this stuff and still make an impact while living in the world. Because I'll tell you, man, I was up in those monasteries and it was very disenchanting being there watching the types of people that would splash up on the beach of these Himalayan monasteries running from our world. And they weren't making a freaking impact. I felt decadent and selfish sitting there with all this time to meditate on my own self-interest while the world was collapsing. And I couldn't make an impact. I had no internet. I had nothing going on in there. I could breathe, you know, I could breathe. Cool. Mm-hmm. Right? And so the real question is, how do you stand back in this world and make an impact? Do you say, okay, well, it's Bitcoin and screw this system. I mean, there's a lot of conversations around all that, right? Like, let's just create a new currency. Let's, you know, end the Fed. I mean, there's a lot of different dialogue that happens, but that happens with 2 feet solidly planted here in society. And, you know, frankly, you know, my internet right now isn't free, right? So how I'm talking to you is, you know, burning some US dollars in a system that already exists. So how do we do that?
And what do you think? How do we do that?
I mean, look, I make films that help people. I write books that help people. I generate money that I feel good about. You know, are there market pressures? You know, are there, you know, economic challenges that come with any business? Of course they are. So you have to iterate. And look, frankly, if I hadn't iterated, been agile, lost sleep, worked my ass off, and done all the things that it takes to be a successful business person, I wouldn't be in business right now. Right. And so the idea that, you know, It's just easier. You can just go do things. To me is, you know, I think there is a certain law of the jungle that applies in the genetic challenges that are presented with the problems that come for us and the innovation and the solutions that come out when you are forced to, you know, be quick on your feet and think and iterate and innovate and all these things that made capitalism wonderful, right? Yeah. Is the innovation and a lot of this kind of expression of that are wonderful. Now, has it taken a wrong turn? Of course it has, right? Yeah. So you know, my dialogue in this space hasn't been this like bleeding heart liberal, and it hasn't been this like, you know, staunch conservative. It's like, look, it's somewhere in between. It's gray. And so let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Let's figure out how to get people who are motivated intrinsically to innovate and grow and help to become more efficient and effective. And in that system, I think capitalism's great.
Yeah, I feel like I land in that same category, basically. Like controlled capitalism, or regulated in a way that does include the well-being of everyone.
Well, I mean, every natural system has a certain natural growth curve and then comes to some sort of stabilizing curve. Otherwise, it's cancer. And so my question would be, what kind of economy could follow that sort of life-supporting curve? And at the moment, we clearly don't have an economy which stops growing. And it's basically eating us. It's eating our planet. And half of the planet's population can't even participate in that kind of crazy system. So it's in the basic root, it is unequal. And we clearly have to reinvent. So I've been intrigued kind of myself, you know, what kind of economy would actually follow that sort of ideal, let's say, life supporting curve?
It's a great question. And it's a big question, obviously. All right. But I think part of it is to unpack the way we have fallen into a CPG type of consumption based economy where it's like, hey, we got to just make more shit. And then you got to keep buying it or else the whole thing collapses and it's unpatriotic to not go to Walmart and buy stuff you don't need. It's just insane, right? And so, okay, so we have goods and we have services. We have consulting. We have food. And so it's really about taking a look at the things, to me, obviously, is taking a look at the things that fill landfills, put carbon back in the sky, do all the things that are obviously detrimental, and put them in one category and start to retool an economy that might value things that are like single use and arts and crafts. Like, you know, there was some story I was reading about like Bic lighters versus how people would have these wonderfully carved, beautiful, like single lighters that they would just refill with butane. It was their lighter. Right. And then like Bic comes around and you got a bunch of plastic everywhere. Right. And a lot of that's been leveraged by the petroleum industry and kind of byproduct of, you know, this kind of oil and gas. And we know so much of the media and distortion in the media and kind of reports about recycling have all just been like, you know, falsified now. So, you know, they're like anything else. You talk about an animal that has an intrinsic motivation to survive. A company and a corporation take on a life of their own, and then they have the same intrinsic motivation saying, look, well, we have 100,000 employees and mouths to feed and a legacy and da 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 da. And it's like all about survival. And they just think about their own survival instead of the greater good. But then what's the flip side of that? Like, are we gonna elect someone emperor? Like, should I just go be emperor of the world and tell everyone what the rules are? And just basically have some sort of hegemonic fascist, you know, rule and just hope that I'm a benevolent dude, right? I would fall, right? Like, I'm not that good, right? And I don't know if any human is noble enough for that type of noble King Arthur rulership. So, you know, it's about establishing kind of a rule around that and establishing a way to clip the wings of this kind of misinformation. I mean, we're in this age of misinformation now that is just disgusting. And, you know, I know personally, there's all these hedge funds out there that are putting out all this misinformation about the coronavirus because they are losing money by people not going to work. So they're like, screw it, you know, go die. It's okay. Just keep the economy going. And they're fueling a lot of this misinformation vehicle. And so you just get to the point where you're like, holy crap, any a-hole can put up a propaganda machine and just change people's minds and put them in a direction where, you know, they're consuming and not questioning and all of it. And so, you know, there needs to be a very big rethinking around the battle for the minds of men, because that right there is where we've lost the wager. Well, before
yeah,
any
I
of this
couldn't agree
stuff.
More.
Yeah, but it seems to be it's like a three-headed monster, because you have politics that need to change, you have economics that need to change, and you have corporate behavior and consumers that need to change. I guess it's more than three heads, but everything needs to change. And the question is kind of, where, how do we do the full court press? How you know, like I come back to your initial statement of we're losing the propaganda war, which is absolutely true. And at the same time, that's driven by an economic system that's profit or die, right? Grow or die, that makes that propaganda system, it fuels that propaganda system. And then you have the politics, which we haven't talked about, making laws that really allow for those unregulated, you know, profiteering, basically, and propaganda. So how do we do the full court press? And I know that your domain is really, you know, kind of the personal mind shift, the personal behavioral shift, right? You live a more mindful lifestyle. And, you know, a lot of your work is focused on that. But I do see you as someone who's a player in this big picture.
Well, you know, here's the thing is, to me, I kind of went full circle and came back to individual personal responsibility in all of this, because at the end of the day, the fundamental units that are contributing to a system that is faulty are the minds of the humans putting their, you know, they're trading their time. However we ended up on planet Earth, we got a certain amount of time and then it's over. And biologically, we generate a certain amount of energy and we eat food and we consume while we're here on planet Earth. And somehow we trade that time and that energy for this thing called money that we then reallocate and distribute to companies that may or may not match our morals and our ethical beliefs and codes. And so, look, the first is, you know, I think this is a crisis of consciousness. More isn't better. Wake up to who you are. Wake up to what you need. Once you have your, like, you know, basic needs met, then what system do you want to feed? What tumor do you want to feed, right? And so if we don't wake up individually to the fact that the propaganda is out there trying to, you know, just take us and have us use our God-given time and energy to manifest someone else's dreams, then we're lost. We're slaves. We're part of a parasitic system and we're just being mined. And that, you know, allows us to really not, you know, look, I've been around this block. You know, you could shake your fist and say ExxonMobil, or like, look, you know, the political system is, you know, taken over by lobbyists and you just buy these whores. And, you know, like there's so many places where you could pick this fight. But at the end of the day, what can I do is I could just elect to not swipe my credit card for that Coca-Cola. I could elect to not buy that brand, and I could elect to put my money with a brand that's reforesting, you know, the Amazon. And that's all well within the reach of my personal power. And if I can't start there, then I'm worried about these huge problems that are bigger than me and most people can't even fathom solving.
You said that it's actually a crisis of consciousness, which is huge, Padram, right? Because basically it would mean that we need to overcome the fear of scarcity. And if we don't overcome the fear of scarcity, within our current prevailing economic system, we are doomed.
But I think he's saying, you know, you can change your behavior by recognizing things aren't really as scarce as they seem to be. Like, you don't have to go to Walmart to buy the plastic Bic lighter. You can choose to use your matches or your lifelong lighter, right? Or your lifelong canteen, but not buy stacks of water bottles. You know, like, you can make those micro choices.
Well, yes, but so both of those things are true, and I've said both of those things, and let me qualify this, because without the consciousness to care or give a damn, first off, you're not going to do it anyways, and secondly, if you're just part of this consumer-based system of just stumbling through your life you know, wondering what show is next and what, you know, what politician embarrassed themselves the most and just caught up in the idiot dramas that are put out in front of us, you're never going to be awake and aware enough to understand what life's intrinsic real value is and the abundance that is truly your God-given right. It's just like, look, I live here and everything's in front of me. And I, you know, yes, I need to feed my family and all that. And so you have to deal with that Maslow's hierarchy. And I do feel that the media and the propaganda are very specifically catering towards leveraging you out into that scarcity consciousness, because that's where you're out of your prefrontal cortex. That's not where you come from, not higher moral reasoning and negation of impulses. You're back in your limbic system and you're like, please, please help me, fix me, protect me, whatever it is, right? You just fall back into this victimhood and then you're just this cog within the machinery of something that's much more orchestrated and sinister than most people want to believe.
So we can, once we're conscious, we can start to say, my needs are more authentic. You know, I can respond to my authentic needs, not the needs that someone's telling me I have.
How many shoes do you need? You know, you got a truck that's, you know, from 1995. Do you really, really need another one? Or is this one still okay? Right? Like all these little things that are just like, you're not man enough because you don't drive this car. You're not, you know, you're not attractive enough because you don't have this fancy purse. I mean, it's all just idiotic leveraging of our animal needs to be desirable and to survive. And it's masterfully crafted by neuroscience and advertising science to a point where like, I'm not smart enough to watch TV. Right? Like it's just, they understand me better than I do. And I've been a monk. So you just got to be really careful with all this messaging.
Yeah. I just want to share an experience I had in India, you know, where we had a conference and talked a lot about sort of the new economy. And there was a student from a university coming up and she was so interested in the topic and very engaged. And then he asked her, so what are you wanting to do in life? And she's like, I want to work for Goldman Sachs. And, you know, it's like, but you can't say anything because it is so understandable. Yeah. You know, obviously the conversation was over, but it was so, it's so understandable that when you come from a poor background and then you made it up to a university and you finally have, you know, kind of worked your ass up and then you can escape to the West, right? And you can have all what is probably also the family always wanted to have or hadn't had. So
it's confounded though. It's confounded because yes, you have your hierarchy of needs and all this, but you've bit into a narrative. If you look at the top universities in America, almost all of them were founded by robber barons that were creating a system to create a class of workers to help manage a class of workers to keep the status quo and basically say, look away. You don't have to worry about money. We'll pay you that. Don't worry. Just go ahead and do as you're told. And no one was ever taught about the monetary system. No one was taught about, like, you know, debt and credit and all the, you know, the central banking and any of the stuff. They're like, look away. You know, that's not for you. Your goal is to get to Goldman Sachs. Your goal is to be the CEO for a company who happens to work for the board, right? And it's like, so they created this pyramid scheme where you can get to the top of the pyramid, but you're still trapped within a system that was created by an education system that tells you what it's like and tells you what it is and told you, look, listen, the goal of life is to work for Goldman Sachs, have a Ferrari, have a beach house, and fly a private jet, right? That's it.
But that's now a self-perpetuating system. There's really no like Oz behind the curtain that's generating those propositions, that paradigm. That's already like, it's already a motor that's just running now. And the question is, who's going to step outside and stop the motor? Or, you know, is it possible that Goldman Sachs will spawn the people that will solve these problems because we have to solve them? Or is it incumbent on us to kind of dispel that whole model altogether and then come up with complete transformative solutions?
I think the new model will rise out of the carcass of the old model. and the Goldman Sachs of the world are very rational players when it comes to all that. I don't think that there's some like Sauron, you know, cutting out rings for people in this thing, right? Or at least not now. Maybe there are. I mean, I'm just an eternal optimist. But I think that the new system needs to be reevaluated beyond the valuation of a company's stock tied to quarterly earnings and perpetual growth in a way that's unsustainable. Building long-term value in an asset of a company can't just be sprints for quarterly earnings in a way that just leads to unsustainable growth and just basically facetious, malevolent behavior trying to dance to a tune that is untenable for the executive core of a company. It's just like they just get crushed. They extract a bunch of value. They go get a bunch of corporate bonds, buy back their stock, create a bunch of fake assets and fake value, and basically rip off the pension funds and create, you know, there's just a huge Ponzi scheme happening across all of these kind of areas of the economy. And it's all because everyone's dancing to a tune trying to make daddy proud on Wall Street. That's going to come to a crashing halt. It has to, right? Because it's just bullshit. It's hot air.
When do you think the crash is going to happen?
I say the crash is happening in the next 2 to 5 years. And I think that we're in the beginning of the crash now. I'm no economist, you know, but you start looking at the telltale signs, it's like fourth turning kind of stuff. Like this is all,
You have to be an economist these days. You know, I mean, an economist, quite frankly, has what today economy is about is so far from the theory of economy. So even the experts, I don't think they actually know what is really happening.
No, and they all listen. They all go, they read the same books, they go to the same things. It's the same idiotic conversations I have around doctors who are all browbeating each other when they step a little bit further out of line and anyone questions anything, because this is what we do, right? It's like this idiot Kool-Aid fraternity thing that happens in every industry I've seen. And so the economists are doing the same thing. Well, this is this and this is that. But you're watching how, you know, the Fed is starting to kind of, people dumping bank stocks for a reason. You see that the credit markets are changing for different reasons. You see some of this writing on the wall. It's just slow because, look, we're in an election year. People have a vested interest in making things, you know, still look good. But it's vacuous, right? Underneath it, there are a lot of very big fundamental problems with the way the economy works, and it's a bubble. And look, we're just as easily going to be, I don't know where you guys are sitting, but we're just as easily going to be in a situation where the US dollar inflates to the point where then the reserve currency shifts to China or somewhere else. And then the US and Western economies just go crashing and no one wants that. So guess what? Got to start a war, right? Because you're going to fight for the hegemony of your currency. And so all these things are in front of us right now. I don't want to be a doom and gloom guy, but this has happened before, right? This has happened.
That was true. It has happened. And anyways, yeah, let's not get into
it. I think we're just going to call you the doom and gloom guy.
Totally. Well, here's the thing. Here's the silver lining, right? Is that entrepreneurs are the way out. Understanding how to innovate and understanding how to be agile and not be part of a system and look at, you know, there's tax incentives. There's a lot of ways to generate wealth. There's a lot of ways to fix the world economy. And look, I spent 18 months of my life looking at people that were doing the right thing. You know, I love companies like Guayaquil. I love companies like Runity. There's a lot of very good examples of people doing it right. Those guys aren't getting the media coverage. Right. And so my job has been to, you know, do the movies and do the films and be like, look at this. This is a shining example of something very positive. Right. And that's not part of the narrative. And so to me, I think that's going to be kind of the core of the economy is companies creating real value and doing things that people sitting right here, people listening to this would be like, oh, yeah, hell yeah, that's cool. I'm in with that. That's the guy who gets my money. Right.
Yeah.
And I think that becomes the basis of a new economy.
I think that's true. I think we've been interviewing entrepreneurs that are really interesting, you know, solutions to air pollution, solutions to carbon emissions, and fantastic young entrepreneurs. And the question is, will they get what they need to make it happen? You know, because they are competing with very huge companies.
Yeah. And a lot of those companies are backed by Goldman Sachs and have, you know, a lot of very big checks, you know, behind them that are coming from an antiquated system that plays by, you know, plays by a different scoreboard. And so I think that the investment vehicles and I like DPOs. I think that there are a lot of vehicles out there that are allowing people to fund people and support people and you know, kind of propel brands into a place where they are making an impact. I think a lot of the challenges are happening are when these brands get to a certain level and need to be able to scale or get to that next iteration, it's the Crafts and the, you know, and kind of the big CPG companies that are waiting to gobble them up. And then they kind of inject their own DNA and change the way they operate. We have a couple of, you know, decent examples. We interviewed Procter & Gamble and a couple of these other companies that were trying to stay hands-off, but they almost can't help themselves, right? Then the board comes in and it's just like, well, what's this? And cut those. And, you know, it's a very difficult time because a lot of these well-intentioned companies are getting bought up by the old guard.
And, you know, from a personal perspective, that can be the goal sometimes, you know, get bought up.
Well, I mean, think about it. You grow this company, you're tired, you've basically burned the midnight oil, you've done your part, you've gotten it to, I don't know, $150 million, right, in value, you've made this impact, you feel really good about yourself. Someone shows up and they're like, here you go, you're a billionaire, go enjoy the beach, you deserve it, and you're tired of fighting the fight. I know a lot of guys that have taken that check.
Is there any questions we haven't asked you you would really like to answer?
I mean, look, where do I see the future going is probably the last thing I'd like to leave there is I think there needs to be a very strong reintegration of the entrepreneurial spirit back into the economy with a system that's less predatory and less compromised. And so we do that by starting an economy with people who are doing stuff and supporting companies and growing companies that do it. And I mean, do we hire lobbyists and play in Washington, or do we, you know, blow it all up and start a new system? I think that's for our kids to decide at this point. Right now, I think we need to reinvigorate capitalism with consciousness and reinvigorate humans with consciousness, come back to our senses, realize the planet's about to blow up on us. And then we have plenty of genius and innovation left in us as a species to get this right. But if we don't come home first to who we are and what our actual needs are, then we're being told what we should want, not necessarily what we need.
Words of wisdom.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. I mean, I 100% agree that it's so important to be conscious about where to spend the dollar.
Right, consumers. Right?
This is like you, the ones who have the choice to actually make a choice between that product, this product, or that company, rather than that company. You have a choice. You should make that choice and make a good choice. Support the ones who go green. But then he pointed out how difficult that also is, right? Because it is so much greenwashing on the market and so difficult to find the right company to support with the conscious dollar. And then not everyone can afford to basically make that choice.
Right. And that's the part where I think there was a kind of a hole in the solutions. It's like, yeah, it's all well and good to tell people not to shop at Walmart, but I would say a vast majority of Americans depend on Walmart kind of prices in order to survive today. I'm not sure. I think it's interesting. I really love the focus that he has on young entrepreneurs that can come up with solutions. I mean, we have spoken to entrepreneurs like Lars, who's doing the carbon sequestration, and Christian, who's doing the air pollution sensors. And so I think that's the kind of entrepreneurship that he's talking about. Fantastic ideas, and hopefully they'll all lift off. But then you also have a market with Shell Oil and, you know, all these giant oil companies pushing their products over these other ones. And it's a very confusing situation, and it's a bit overwhelming.
Well, I almost wanted to correct you guys there when you talked about the next generation, you know, because in a way there won't be a next generation if those problems aren't tackled now. So the entrepreneurs are not going to be his kids. Well, hopefully, yes, as well, but it is today. It is today we have to not only have those solutions at hand, but also implement them and finance them and get those brains out and actually get through the market and be supported and get the right kind of financial support as well. And I think that's the challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Or is that too dooming? It is pretty dooming, you know, because there is this, when he talked, I had this feeling, oh, there's basically going to be like these two. Well, at the moment, we have this wealth divide, right? Especially here in the States. It's, I mean, so obvious. You're either rich or you're not. There is basically no middle class anymore. And so pandemic, you either move out of the city or you're trapped in the city. In this case of New York City, right? So, and he's right about this. I think that has been happening, and it's very clear that there is a huge divide. And then when he was talking, I almost had this feeling like, oh, okay, in the future, this divide is not necessarily about how much money you have, but how much consciousness you have.
Yeah, but also this whole Maslow's hierarchy, if you're someone who's dealing with your basic needs, you're not going to have space for consciousness. But so really what we're coming down to is the elite, the people who are wealthy, are the ones who have to solve this problem because no one else has the time or bandwidth to solve it or resources. And the few who will trickle up are very resourceful or very, you know, kind of exceptional. But for by and large, we're in a condition in society where the problems we're facing must be solved by the people that are causing those problems. And we were looking for transformative solutions and not necessarily seeing them coming from that same population. And so we are in a bit of a conundrum. And I was struck by, in some ways, the contradictions that Pedram represents. You know, he's this former monk, and he said life was easy as a monk, and then he decides he needs to make a difference, so he jumps into the fray, and now he's in the fray and competing for those capital dollars like everyone else. And that's where the solution comes from, strong entrepreneurs. And, you know, I appreciate and respect the position and the complexity of the position, and I'm looking for something more transformative.
Well, you see, and this is where the money game comes in. Yeah, when we talked a lot about the lifestyle game, the propaganda game, and now let's talk a little bit about the money game, because you said like it is basically about up to the rich people to now find the solution, or not just find the finance the solutions. Yeah, find the right people to support in order that those solutions systemically get installed to save humanity, basically. That means basic financially independence. Yeah, so you as an entrepreneur should become financially independent. Then you can do it freely. You can offer the talents to the world.
Or you can invest in other entrepreneurs.
So within the money game, this means you have to play that game until you become financially independent to then save the world. And that's kind of a conundrum in itself.
No, that's what Lars was saying on the podcast about the carbon sequestration is free people up by having them become successful entrepreneurs so they can use their leisure time after that to solve
world
problems.
Yeah, but that's a very short-term thinking, because they're never going to be freed up. You're playing the money game, which is basically based on the fear of scarcity and fear in the first place. You're not going to shift once you got the money. Once you got the money, you want to have more money.
Yeah, that's
the
problem.
The few who really then shift into then giving their money and supporting others are, I would say, ridiculously few at the moment. We have a couple, like 8 people in America who could basically solve the wealth gap in America.
Yeah. And that would be transformative.
No.
Yeah, maybe we put the billionaires in the monastery and then move on from there.
We're an independent, listener-supported podcast.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul.
Support us by rating this episode and sharing with all your friends.
And to learn more, join us at potofgold.world.
I'm Stephanie Overbach.
And I'm Mel Wymore.
Thanks for listening.